WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our director, Roberta Shorrock, recently brought me a poem by Billy Collins about memory, or more precisely, about losing your memory, forgetfulness. I thought it perfectly described the frustrations of not being able to recall a book or a name or part of your life. Billy Collins has plenty of poems that perfectly describe ordinary feelings. As part of our celebration of National Poetry Month, we invited him to read a few and talk about his work. Billy Collins has won several poetry awards. He's been published in the 1992, 93, and 97 editions of the anthology Best American Poetry. He's a professor of English at City University of New York. His latest collection of poems is called Picnic Lightning. Well, Billy, I want you to read your poem, Forgetfulness. I think you've described this as your Over the Rainbow poem. Like one of your, is this like your greatest hit?
It is my one hit, and I feel embarrassed about reading it so many times. But then again, I think that the Coasters never stopped singing Charlie Brown. They never got tired of that. So it is. I think it has a kind of instant appeal because it's about something that's both humorous, because we make fun of forgetfulness of, you know, people, absent-minded professors and people walking around with their glasses on their head looking for them. But at the same time, the loss of memory is frightening, and I try to handle both aspects of that.
Would you read it for us?
Sure. Forgetfulness. The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion. The entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. It is as if, one by one, the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye, and you watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away. A state flower, perhaps, the address of an uncle, the capital of Paraguay. Whatever it is you are struggling to remember, it is not poised on the tip of your tongue, not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a dark mythological river whose name begins with an L, as far as you can recall, well on your own way to oblivion, where you will join those who have even forgotten how to swim and how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart.
Oh, this is the story of my life.
Anyone over 10 can relate to that.
Oh, that's right. You know, I think it's probably particularly frightening to feel like you're losing your memory when you're a writer, because so much of your material comes from your life, which you've lived and are beginning to forget.
Indeed. And I think it starts with books, though, I think. John Updike said that he was, I think, about halfway through this Melville novel, Redburn, I think it was, before he realized that he'd read it before. And he came to that realization because he found his own notations in the margin. So losing the library that you've spent so many years collecting in your mind is also a kind of frightening loss.
Now, the poem about forgetfulness that you just read us, do you know it by heart?
I do know that one by heart, yes.
That's good. and how did you get to memorize it? Did you have to? Is it just from having read it a lot?
It's just from having read it a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think it has now that poetry has kind of dropped end rhyme at least and regular meter, it's much more difficult to memorize. But if I think one thing that helps you memorize a poem is the rhythmic quality of it. If it has a certain sure-footed rhythm, it's much easier to get it into your head. And I think that's the case with that poem.
My guest is poet Billy Collins, and his latest book is called Picnic Lightning. Well, it's spring, and a lot of people are starting to plan vacations. It's vacation planning time, if you're lucky enough to have the time and money to afford to go on a vacation. You have a great poem about having to stay home, not being able to go on that vacation. And the poem is called Consolation. Would you tell us the story behind the poem before you read it to us?
Sure. I had planned to go to Europe with my wife one summer, and because of circumstances beyond our control, we had to scrub these plans, and we stayed home for the summer. And I was trying to convince myself in this poem of the merits of just hanging around the house and not going anywhere. I think it's an unconvincing consolation, but nonetheless, I'll read the poem. It's called Consolation. How agreeable it is not to be touring Italy this summer, wandering her cities and ascending her torrid hill towns. How much better to cruise these local, familiar streets, fully grasping the meaning of every road sign and billboard and all the sudden hand gestures of my compatriots. There are no abbeys here, no crumbling frescoes or famous domes, and there is no need to memorize a succession of kings or tour the dripping corners of a dungeon, no need to stand around a sarcophagus, see Napoleon's little bed on Elba, or view the bones of a saint under glass. How much better to command the simple precinct of home than be dwarfed by pillar, arch, and basilica? Why hide my head in phrasebooks and wrinkled maps? Why feed scenery into a hungry, one-eyed camera, eager to eat the world one monument at a time? Instead of slouching in a cafe, ignorant of the word for ice, I will head down to the coffee shop and to the waitress known as Dot. I will slide into the flow of the morning paper, all language barriers down, rivers of idiom running freely, eggs over easy, on the way. And after breakfast, I will not have to find someone willing to photograph me with my arm around the owner. I will not puzzle over the bill or record in a journal what I had to eat and how the sun came in the window. It is enough to climb back into the car, as if it were the great car of English itself, and sounding my loud vernacular horn, speed off down a road that will never lead to Rome, not even Bologna.
One of the things I really like about your poetry is, well, how plain spoken it is in a way. I mean, it's about very ordinary experience, and it uses an ideal version of ordinary language.
I think poetry, poetic language, is in fact that. It's language that is kind of tidied. It's language that's steam cleaned or purified. Language that's that comes under principles of organization and even neatness that are missing in certainly conversation and even in well-written prose, perhaps.
Did your poems always stick to ordinary life and always have the directness that they have, or did you ever write in other styles?
No, I wrote in awful styles when I started, mostly slavishly imitative styles.
Of who?
William Carlos Williams, Wallace Stevens, Ferlinghetti, producing really awful versions of almost unintentional parodies of these people. And it was really before I found my voice. I mean, that expression is one I'm not happy with. It sounds like it's like your voice is slipped behind the couch or something. But I think when I started to write poems that I felt only I could have written, and I think that's the point you either get to or you don't in writing poems, I felt that I had released a lot of myself into the poems. And they did become, as you said, more relaxed. They started out, at least, on very conversational notes. I think it's a sign of my overall obsession with attracting and keeping readers. I mean, all the poems have different subjects, but I think the ultimate subject of all these poems is the engagement that takes place between the poem and the reader. I don't think readers enjoy being led down a flight of stairs into an unlit basement, and that's the feeling I get from reading quite a few contemporary poems.
Well, I know exactly what you mean, and there's a lot of poems where I'll really love the beginning, and then I just totally get lost deeper in, and the imagery becomes so obscure. I might like the way the language sounds, but I have no idea sometimes what the poet is communicating.
Yes, there are, I mean... I think there are several reasons for obscurity in poetry, and one of them is just maybe hide the banality of what's really being said. I mean, I'm not really greatly concerned with the large issue of what the audience is for American poetry, but I'm very deeply concerned about the audience for my poetry, and I try to address that concern in every poem I write, usually by starting out on some familiar note so that the poem at least begins with something we share in common. Then I feel the poem can take the reader on an unfamiliar ride, perhaps, and take him to a place of surprise toward the end. But I really think that I'm supplying half of a possible engagement, and that the second half of that takes place in the reader's mind.
I know what you mean, and I think as a reader, one of the things I gravitate to about your poems is a sense of recognition, you know, of like, oh yeah, I know that feeling, I've had that feeling, I've experienced the forgetfulness that you're describing, I've experienced not being able to take that vacation.
I think the case might be that most of the poems that I'm writing and the ones I've been reading are of my own are not so much memory-driven, but they're more conceptually driven, not by a big concept, but maybe just by a little notion.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend not to write about my past in the way that, a kind of autobiographical way that poems would include as their kind of nervous subjects, the family or their childhoods. There seems to be today two kinds of poets. One has had a miserable childhood and the other has had a happy childhood. And the people with happy childhoods write about a variety of things, and the people with miserable childhoods just write about the misery of childhood over and over again. But I think, I don't want to presume that anyone's interested in my past. I think they might be more interested in a notion that overlaps all of our experience.
My guest is poet Billy Collins. His latest collection is called Picnic Lightning. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Billy Collins. His latest collection is called Picnic Lightning. There's a poem I want you to read called Asobuco, and this is really a poem about contentment. Is contentment a difficult thing to write about?
It is nearly impossible to write about, I think. I think it's very challenging to write about, because serious art, at least since the Romantics, since about, you know, the beginning of the 19th century, serious art takes sadness as a given. And I think people are very suspicious of literary works that include or center on pleasure, happiness, contentment. But of course, these things are part of our lives.
But the kind of contentment that this poem is describing, it isn't even like ecstasy or the big happiness. It's merely contentment.
It's a small bit of contentment, and I think the poem gets a little more complicated than that later on.
Why don't you read it for us?
I'd be glad to. It's called Osobuco. I love the sound of the bone against the plate and the fortress-like look of it lying before me in a moat of risotto, the meat soft as the leg of an angel who has lived a purely airborne existence. And best of all, the secret marrow, the invaded privacy of the animal, prized out with a knife and swallowed down with cold, exhilarating wine. I am swaying now in the hour after dinner, a citizen tilted back on his chair, a creature with a full stomach, something you don't hear much about in poetry, that sanctuary of hunger and deprivation. You know, the driving rain, the boots by the door, small birds searching for berries in winter. But tonight, the lion of contentment has placed a warm, heavy paw on my chest, and I can only close my eyes and listen to the drums of woe throbbing in the distance, and the sound of my wife's laughter on the telephone in the next room, the woman who cooked the savory osobuco, who pointed to show the butcher the one she wanted, she who talks to her faraway friend while I linger here at the table with a hot companionable cup of tea, feeling like one of the friendly natives, a reliable guide, maybe even the chief's favorite son. Somewhere a man is crawling up a rocky hillside on bleeding knees and palms, an Irish penitent carrying the stone of the world in his stomach. And elsewhere, people of all nations stare at one another across a long, empty table. But here the candles give off their warm glow, the same light that Shakespeare and Isaac Walton wrote by, the light that lit and shadowed the faces of history. Only now it plays on the blue plates, the crumpled napkins, the crossed knife and fork. In a while, one of us will go up to bed, and the other one will follow. Then we will slip below the surface of the night into miles of water, drifting down and down to the dark, soundless bottom, until the weight of dreams pulls us lower still, below the shale and layered rock, beneath the strata of hunger and pleasure, into the broken bones of the earth itself, into the marrow of the only place we know.
How did you decide to write that poem?
I don't know where the poems are going. Most poets say that, but it does tend to be true. I think I did start with simply an attempt to write a little poem in praise of a pleasure of eating this terrific meal. I didn't know where it was going, and I think of the poems as little journeys or little rides, if you will, as kind of cheap forms of transportation. And I like to end up in a very different place at the end of the poem than I started at the beginning. And, I mean, here I start at the kitchen table and I end up kind of in the middle of the earth. So it's that kind of travel that interests me. I think it's a little like writing the poem and not knowing exactly where you're going. It's a little like driving a car at night where the headlights allow you to see ahead of yourself just so far in order to keep the thing going, but you can't see any farther than that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Billy Collins, and his latest collection of poems is called Picnic Lightning. You teach, and you do a lot of poetry workshops, and you actually have a poem that's very funny about, I think it's about trying to give constructive feedback to poets who are writing not very good poems. I'm going to ask you to read just a short excerpt of this poem workshop.
Okay.
Can you start with the maybe it's just me part?
Sure. I'll just say it is the voice of someone in a workshop who is trying to analyze or understand a poem a poem that lies in back of this one and that we gather from the attempt is really difficult to understand. Maybe it's just me, but the next stanza is where I start to have a problem. I mean, how can the evening bump into the stars, and what's an obligato of snow? Also, I roam the decaffeinated streets. At that point, I'm lost. I need help. The other thing that throws me off, and maybe this is just me, is the way the scene keeps shifting around. First we're in this big aerodrome, and the speaker is inspecting a row of dirigibles, which makes me think this could be a dream. Then he takes us into his garden, the part with the dahlias and the coiling hose. Though that's nice, the coiling hose. But then I'm not sure where we're supposed to be. The rain and the mint-green light, that makes it feel outdoors. But what about this wallpaper? Or is it a kind of indoor cemetery? There's something about death going on here. In fact, I start to wonder if what we have here is really two poems, or three, or four, or possibly none. But then there's that last stanza, my favorite. This is where the poem wins me back, especially the line spoken in the voice of the mouse. I mean, we've all seen these images in cartoons before, but I still love the details he uses when he describes where he lives. The perfect little arch of an entrance in the baseboard, the bed made out of a curled-back sardine can, the spool of thread for a table. I start thinking about how hard the mouse had to work, night after night, collecting all these things, while all the people in the house were fast asleep. And that gives me a very strong feeling, a very powerful sense of something. But I don't know if anyone else was feeling that. Maybe that was just me. Maybe that's just the way I read it.
Billy Collins, is there a specific poem you're referring to in this?
No, there's not. It's just meant to suggest that there's a terribly disorganized and nonsensical poem that's being discussed here
right.
at great length.
No. Do you have when you're critiquing such a poem? In one of your workshops, do you have nice ways or just direct ways of expressing what you think of the poem?
Well, you, Nice as possible to a point. I think the you want to separate the writer from the poem, and the workshop is the first step in doing that. Usually the writer doesn't talk during the discussion in my workshops. I think you try to establish the independence of the poem. And once you do that, what the comments that you offer are really comments about the poem and not the poet. And so it's nothing should be taken as an offense, although people are obviously are connected to the work they've done. But the idea is to help the poem stand up on its own two feet and achieve some independent life from the poet.
Do you find that you've had a lot of students who try much too hard to find that big metaphor to put into a poem?
Yes, the advice is always save something for the next poem. If they try to write about life, consciousness, death, the vortex of loneliness, etc. Usually the mistakes are of starting too big, of not looking just around oneself into the moment. I mean, to see that poems really are strewn all around us potentially, but what we need to do is be attentive. I think it's that kind of vigilance that to daily life, to what lies around us, that that can trigger poems rather than the big ideas that are delivered from a cliff.
Billy Collins is the author of several poetry collections. His latest, Picnic Lightning, is published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with poet Billy Collins. His latest collection of poems is called Picnic Lightning. You're very good in your poems at describing how effortless writing sometimes can be and how difficult it could be at other times. In a poem called Tuesday, June 4th, 1991, you write, "I feel like the secretary to the morning, whose only responsibility is to take down its bright, airy dictation. Until it's time to go to lunch with the other girls, all of us ordering the cottage cheese with half a pear." but then you have another poem about how hard it is to write, and I was trying to find that poem this morning, and I couldn't find it, so maybe you know the poem I'm talking about.
I'm not sure of the poem, but I think there are two. I mean, sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's hard. There's kind of a downhill poem, and there's kind of that does tend to write itself slightly, and then there's a very uphill poem that requires a tremendous amount of sweat. You know, it's very different for different poets. I think it's some poets, they're talking, it's 90% revision. It's a little like, I've compared it to what I consider the two styles of cooking. One style of cook cleans, you clean as you go along, right? You kind of dice up a carrot and then you have to clean off the board and the other type just makes a huge mess and cleans it up later. And I think some writers want to get it right the first time. They can't proceed with the next sentence until the first one is correct. And my style is more to make a mess, just to crash through and to keep something of the spontaneity of the moment. Because the person who comes back to revise the poem is really a different person. It's like Heraclitus talking about not being able to stick your foot in the same stream twice. The person who comes back the next morning to revise or the next month to revise is a slightly different creature. And I'd rather not have the poem be a kind of collaboration between all these sides of myself. I'd rather have the heart of it, at least the thrust of it, come out of one moment, of one sitting, one mood.
Now, most of your poems are really not very autobiographical. They're about discrete moments in time, but they're not going over, you know, your childhood, the story of your life. How much of that is because of wanting to maintain a sense of privacy?
I think it's more trying to maintain a sense of audience, really. I don't presume to feel that anyone is... I mean, I know from experience that most people, for instance, are not interested in anyone else's family but their own. Or if they are, it's in a much less intense and way. And
but they're interested in reading about other people's families who are like their own.
Yes, I suppose so. I think, you know, you read kind of to discover, not the poet, but you just read to discover yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to start in the past. Most of the poems try to start in this discrete moment, a little haiku-like. I mean, haiku is the great form that kind of boxes in a tiny moment. And I like to have the poem begin with the occasion of its own present. I don't want to. I'm a little bored by poems that begin and stay in the past. I feel that fiction can do that better than poetry.
You're, I think, very aware of, you know, the language, the different languages we have for different things. And one of your poems is in part about the language of catalogs, particularly fancy female lingerie catalogs. This poem I'm thinking of is called Victoria's Secret. And maybe you could say a few words about reading this poem before you read us an excerpt of, about writing the poem before you read us an excerpt of it.
Well, we're all familiar with this catalog, and it comes to our house very frequently, a number of times a week, it seems. And it's various.
That's right.
It has lots of guises and manifestations, but it's basically the same catalog in different form. And I don't know why we get this catalog. My wife must have ordered something like a belt or a pair of sunglasses at some point. It's very distracting to have this with the mail almost every day. And I, again, as a way of kind of dealing with it, I wrote this poem. And the poem tries to recapture the process of actually leafing through the magazine. And it also tries to include a lot of the amazing jargon that is in the copy next to the pictures. So what I'll do, it's kind of a long poem because the catalog is so long, but maybe what I'll do is read portions of it. Victoria's Secret. The one in the upper left-hand corner is giving me a look that says, I know you are here, and I have nothing better to do for the remainder of human time than return your persistent but engaging stare. She is wearing a deeply scalloped flame-stitch halter top with padded push-up styling and easy side-zip tap pants. I wet my thumb and flip the page. Here, the one who happens to be reclining in a satin and lace Merry Widow with an insert lace up front, decorated underwire cups and bodice with lace ruffles along the bottom, and hook-and-eye closure in the back, is wearing a slightly contorted expression, her head thrust back, mouth partially open, a confusing mixture of pain and surprise, as if she had stepped on a tack just as I was breaking down her bedroom door with my shoulder. Opposite her, stretched out cat-like on a couch in the warm glow of a paneled library, is one who wears a distinctly challenging expression, her face tipped up, exposing her long neck, her perfectly flared nostrils. Go ahead, her expression tells me. Take off my satin charmeuse gown with a sheer jacquard bodice, decorated with a touch of shimmering lurex. Go ahead, fling it into the fireplace. What do I care, her eyes say. We're all going to hell anyway. And occupying the whole facing page is one who displays that expression we have come to associate with photographic beauty. Yes, she is pouting about something. All lower lip and cheekbone. Perhaps her ice cream has tumbled out of its cone onto the parquet floor. Perhaps she has been waiting all day for a new sofa to be delivered, waiting all day in a stretch lace hipster with lattice edging, satin frog closures, velvet scrollwork, cuffed ankles, flare silhouette, and knotted shoulder straps. But this is already too much. Who has the time to linger on these delicate lures, these once unmentionable things? Life is rushing by like a mad, swollen river. One minute roses are opening in the garden, and the next snow is flying past my window. Plus, the phone is ringing, the dog is whining at the door, rain is beating on the roof, and as always, there is a list of things I have to do before the night descends, black and silky, and the dark hours begin to hurtle by before the little doors of the body swing shut, and I ride to sleep, my closed eyes still burning from all the glossy lights of day.
Billy, how did this really funny poem about the models in the Victoria's Secret catalog and the kind of language describing, you know, the fancy-schmancy language describing the fancy-schmancy lingerie, how did that end up in Sleep and Dreams in this larger meditation on life?
I think it follows the pattern of you know, a number of my poems that try to begin with something amusing, perhaps, and as an attempt, finally, although this goes on a bit, this poem, but finally, maybe the humor is an attempt to kind of disarm the reader so as to make the reader a little more susceptible to something that might come, that might be more serious and that might come toward the end of the poem. I mean, humor in poetry is a touchy thing because I think people, it's considered to be opposed to seriousness. But I consider humor a kind of door into the serious. I think it's a way of gaining access to deeper themes.
My guest is poet Billy Collins. His latest collection is called Picnic Lightning. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Billy Collins, and his latest collection of poems is called Picnic Lightning. A lot of your poems have to do with sleep and dreams. Several of your poems end there. Some of your poems are just totally about that. And I'm wondering if sleep is often restful for you.
I'm just lazy is what you're implying. Well, Keats is the great poet of sleep and dreams and drowsiness, which was thought to be a kind of a receptive state of mind. It might be that I just have too much time on my hands. Max Beerbohm once said that the hardest thing about being a poet was knowing what to do with the other 23 and a half hours in the day.
Right. How long are you going to really sit there and write?
That's right.
Yeah. So do you take a lot of naps?
I do when I can, yes. And I think waking up from a nap or from sleep is a very good state in which to think about things to write about and even to begin writing. Before the language of the world has a chance to infiltrate your ears, before you hear the radio or someone else talking or read a newspaper, I think that's a good time to write because I think language can be fresher in those occasions when you're closer to sleep.
You have a poem called The Night House, which is in part about sleep and the difference between the waking mind and the unconscious mm-hmm. mind, the sleeping mind.
It's a poem. It's kind of a meditation on, another great time to write, of course, is as a response to insomnia. And I suppose the poem is kind of a meditation on insomnia and also a sense that things happen when we're asleep. You know how in those old cartoons like the teapot and all the things in the kitchen come alive? And but this is a sense that the body itself begins to kind of go off in its own directions. Shall I read it?
Please.
The Night House. Every day, the body works in the fields of the world, mending a stone wall or swinging a sickle through the tall grass, the grass of civics, the grass of money. And every night the body curls around itself and listens for the soft bells of sleep. But the heart is restless and rises from the body in the middle of the night, leaves the trapezoidal bedroom with its thick, pictureless walls to sit by herself at the kitchen table and heat some milk in a pan. And the mind gets up too, puts on a robe and goes downstairs, lights a cigarette and opens a book on engineering. Even the conscience awakens and roams from room to room in the dark, darting away from every mirror like a strange fish. And the soul is up on the roof in her nightdress, straddling the ridge, singing a song about the wildness of the sea until the first rip of pink appears in the sky. Then they will all return to the sleeping body, the way a flock of birds settles back into a tree, resuming their daily colloquy, talking to each other or themselves, even through the heat of the long afternoons. Which is why the body, that house of voices, sometimes puts down its metal tongs, its needle, or its pen, to stare into the distance, to listen to all its names being called before bending again to its labor.
That's a beautiful poem.
Thank you, Terry.
You know, on those nights when you can't sleep, when you do have insomnia, do you panic about life in general?
Well, there, I mean, that nervousness, that the anxiety or the coffee or whatever it is that doesn't let you sleep is something that makes the pen jitter. I mean, this is the stuff that I think poets, you know, wag their tails over. It is a nervous response. It is a nervous sign that there's some turbulence or some disturbance in your inner life. And for me, one of the functions or one of the beauties of poetry is that it's something to do with your inner life. It's an activity. The writing and the construction of poems is an external activity that brings the inner life out of yourself and gives you a way to deal with it and understand it.
Another theme that you often write about is music. You obviously really love music, soul music, jazz, a lot of poems about jazz. You even have a poem about reading the saxophonist Art Pepper's autobiography, and a wonderful poem about piano lessons. Would you talk a little bit about the interplay between music and poetry for you? And I should preface this by saying that poetry about jazz is often a really frightening prospect, because there's a lot of really bad jazz poems in which the poet does a really lousy job of trying to use words to sound like a bebop solo, and exactly. It just ends up sounding like a failed hipster instead. And I don't think that your poems try to approximate bop solos. I think they try to approximate your feelings about music or
That's very well put, because I think there's a lot of really bad jazz poetry, and it's bad for the reasons that you say. I think it's what those poets are doing has been called the imitative fallacy, that they're trying to actually make the poem come off as a sounding like jazz. For me, if I write about jazz, it's simply as a subject matter. It could be about, I mean, I have a poem about learning to play a song on the piano. I have sort of meditations on listening to music, on how a particular piece by Thelonious Monk seems to accompany the snow that's falling outside the window. I think it's a kind of, I think the music puts one in a kind of meditative, slightly meditative state. And there's a lot of different subjects. A lot of different angles to jazz. And there's something in common, I suppose, because to the degree that writing, I think, should at least give the illusion of having an improvisational spirit to it, that it doesn't seem completely planned out. It seems to be finding its way through itself the way alto solo would.
I'd like you to end with a poem called Nightclub, and perhaps you can introduce it for us before you read it.
Okay. I this is a poem about jazz in some ways, but I literally started writing it when I was at the typewriter one day, and there was an album playing in the background, and it was a famous album with Johnny Hartman and John Coltrane, and it was playing in the other room, though, and all I could hear words like, "You're so beautiful," and "I'm such a fool to be in love with you," and that kind of thing. And I just wrote those words down and realized that there are so many songs that have that theme to them. And then the poem took off from there. It's called Nightclub. "You are so beautiful, and I am a fool to be in love with you" is a theme that keeps coming up in songs and poems. There seems to be no room for variation. I have never heard anyone sing, "I am so beautiful, and you are a fool to be in love with me," even though this notion has surely crossed the minds of women and men alike. "You are so beautiful, too bad you are a fool" is another one you don't hear, or "You are a fool to consider me beautiful," that one you will never hear, guaranteed. For no particular reason this afternoon, I am listening to Johnny Hartman, whose dark voice can curl around the concepts of love, beauty, and foolishness like no one else's can. It feels like smoke curling up from a cigarette someone left burning on a baby grand piano around 3 o'clock in the morning, smoke that billows up into the bright lights while, out there in the darkness, some of the beautiful fools have gathered around little tables to listen. some with their eyes closed, others leaning forward into the music as if it were holding them up, or twirling the loose ice in a glass, slipping by degrees into a rhythmic dream. Yes, there is all this foolish beauty, born beyond midnight, that has no desire to go home, especially now when everyone in the room is watching the large man with the tenor sax that hangs from his neck like a golden fish. He moves forward to the edge of the stage and hands the instrument down to me and nods that I should play. So I put the mouthpiece to my lips and blow into it with all my living breath. We are all so foolish, my long bebop solo begins by saying, so damn foolish we have become beautiful without even knowing it.
Billy Collins, I love your poems. I want to thank you so much for reading some of them for us. I wish we had time for some more.
The pleasure's been all mine, Terry.
Billy Collins' latest collection of poems, Picnic Lightning, is published by the University of Pittsburgh Press.